Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. In this episode, we hear from legendary fiction writer Annie Proulx. Proulx is recognized as an important chronicler of Western life as it has changed over the past 50 years. She upends cliches about so-called cowboy life and shows how the modern world has affected its people, culture, politics, and social attitudes. At the time of her talk in Portland, this was 2011, she was on tour to promote a book of nonfiction called Bird Cloud about the building of her new home in a remote part of Wyoming. But the book is, of course, about more than a house. It's about Proulx's relationship to place, which serves as the inspiration and source for so much of her material. She also talks about a work of untitled fiction that was, at the time, in progress. The work she was referring to turned out to be the novel Barkskins, which was released to acclaim in June 2016. This part of the talk provides fascinating insight into her research and writing process because she had yet to fully realize the novel. Here's Proulx.
Good evening, and thank you all for coming. I'm very pleased to be back in Portland again. Every time I come here, I wonder how it would be to live here. So, quite a few people seem to like it. If I look a bit disheveled tonight, it's because I am disheveled. It's been a very busy year. I spent a couple of months in Australia and New Zealand and got back to the States just in time to get up to Bird Cloud, my house in Wyoming, and prepare for the big flood which was coming because we had an immense amount of snow packed in the mountains, in the Sierra Madre and the Medicine Bows. And indeed, the flood came. Since then, we've been busy getting rid of the thousands of trees, bushes, squashed canoes, and odd cows that it left on the property. And so it's been a busy time. And the last time that I was in the hairdressers was sometime in 2010. But so what? Probably the most important thing that you should know about me is that I am a reader. I have always been a reader, and it'll probably be the last thing that I do. I'll be reading when I conk out, but that's okay too. I am the oldest of five girls, grew up very bookish and shy. My family was a bit odd. My father was French-Canadian by descent at a time when it was not cool. And my mother was an old Yankee, and she, in her turn, was exceedingly shy, very retiring. She wanted to be a painter, but in the time that her lifetime fell, that chance was never there. She and her favorite sister, Gloriana, were boon companions, and they both spent a lot of their time with pencils and sketch pads and drawing. And we grew up on the stories they told about coming home from school with their sketch pads. There was a dead horse or a dead cow by the side of the road. And for weeks, they sketched it as it changed size. But they're both gone now. And one of the most precious things that I have are paintings that my mother left. And if any of you have things that you do by hand, you know how much quilts are esteemed, but paintings and drawings and things that are made by the hand of the person who's no longer with you are just more precious than I can say. There's nothing finer to do than to leave your children something you made. Apropos of my mother, who was shy and retiring, women are really never alone in our culture. We're denied time for reflection and meditation. After my youngest child left home, I discovered the pleasures of solitude and silence. I grew up at a time when marriage was the thing. So I married and had children. But I kept on reading, losing myself in imagined worlds. And it's true, I did like beige books when I was in grade school. This all began with Nordophon Hall's Mutiny on the Bounty, which carried me away into the South Seas. It was a beige book. I had quite a lot of luck picking beige books in our in our library. Gradually, I began to write, not starting with fiction, but articles for horticulture, magazines, books on rural living, apple cider, and that sort of thing. And I kept looking for some half-wild place. As children, I think we often experience inchoate and unspecified longings, those childhood moods and feelings of something important that's out there. Roger MacDonald, in his latest novel, he's an Australian author, some of you may know his work. He's a very fine writer. His latest novel, When Colts Ran, hits the right tone when the boy, Eddie, runs along the ridge track with a pile of dark rocks, outlines the edge, and he cries out, "Oh, the crossing, the crossing." We don't know what the crossing is, but we understand that it's one of those things that has seized the boy. A friend of mine who grew up in Wyoming walked home from school every day, a trip of about 2 miles from the school to his house. When he was 10, one day he was shuffling along the dusty road and he saw a white thing in the distance. The thing was leaping and flopping in the wind, but it was obviously held in place because it was wrapped around a barbed wire fence. He didn't know what it was, so he got through the fence and walked way up the hill toward the flapping thing. And he saw that it was a dress, an old white batiste dress with a tucked bodice, antique lace, much stained by red dirt, and it was torn by the barbs of the fence. He took it carefully off the fence, folded it up, took it home. He kept it for years. When he grew up and became a man, he was an artist, and he made curious sculptures of headless female torsos in antique dresses, gauzy and stained, and they were very beautiful. Although there were no beautiful torn dresses like that in my childhood, when I heard this story, I felt that I had been the one to see it. I understood because I too had experienced those longings for something unknown, and even now that same feeling evoked by certain pieces of music or newly discovered places. I think probably everybody has these feelings, but how difficult it is to put them down on the page. I was, like most everybody, made to read Thoreau's Walden Pond, and I'm a New Englander by birth and heritage, and I didn't think much of Walden Pond. I thought it was rather dull. But recently, last year, as a matter of fact, the New York Public Library was having one of its galas, and they were going to put a book together with composed of, the book would be made up of pieces written by people who had done research at the library, particularly in the manuscripts. And they asked me if I would write something. I was not sure what I should write about, and I hadn't really done that much research in the manuscripts of the Berg. But Isaac Gewertz, who is the librarian for the Berg collection of manuscripts, suggested that the Thoreau manuscript on seed dispersion would be of interest. It was and is. I've been working for a long time on a novel that is concerned with trees and forests. So I went to New York and I went to the Berg Collection and I sat down with Thoreau's manuscript in his own horrible hand and read what I could of it, although it was mighty tough going. His handwriting is dreadful. It's large and loopy and a bit crazed. But I found the manuscript to be intensely interesting. 126 years after he died, it was finally published. And the book is called Faith in a Seed, kind of a sappy title, but the book itself was exceedingly lovely. Reading it, I became quite excited because it took me back to my childhood in a very peculiar way. So many of the trees and plant species that Thoreau knew and regarded and watched as though they were his children are now gone. In his innocence, he never suspected what we would do to our forests and our trees. Through casual imports, unbridled cutting, poor management practices, the woods of Concord in his time are not our woods. Outraged, he once chided a neighbor who had cut down his pine woodlot, and when young oaks followed in succession, burned them off and planted rye. So he trifles with nature. I am chagrined for him. That he should call himself an agriculturist. He needs to have a guardian placed over him. But just think what has happened to the trees that Thoreau knew. The chestnut in his time made up one-third of the eastern forest. It was the most useful tree then known, made into house siding, floors, fine furniture, fence rails, and even, in Thoreau's time, railroad sleepers. In my mother's lifetime, it still grew here and there in Connecticut, but was already dying from the dreadful chestnut blight. Thoreau didn't know about the blight, which entered American forests 40 years after his death, but he did worry about the excessive cutting of this tree. It is now comparatively scarce and costly, and there is danger if we do not take unusual care that this tree will become extinct here. That might have happened, but the blight got there first. Around 1900, the killer came into the United States either through infected imported lumber or through the efforts of tree hybridizers wanting bigger chestnuts and who thought to get them by crossing the native tree with the Chinese chestnut. Alas, the Chinese variety carried the fatal fungus. And within a human generation, millions of American chestnuts were gone. I think there are in the upper Midwest some trees that still exist, and even in New England, the old, old roots keep trying every year, sending up sprouts that get to a certain size before the blight grabs them. And the American elm was once the distinctive tree of New England, its graceful wine glass shape found throughout the forests and along the streets of 1,000 towns. But cabinet makers imported English elm for its beautiful patterned veneers, and the English logs were infested with bark beetles carrying a vicious fungus that carried the Dutch elm disease. There were still elms during my childhood, and that was a while ago. But as I walked home from school, I saw the sidewalks and byways of New England become sun-scalded strips with enormous stumps, and that's all that remained of those exquisite elms. And I can remember gathering butternuts at a very early age with my mother, chocolate-colored nuts that looked as though they were wearing velvet jackets, but they were terrifically sticky and stained your hands and clothes. The velvet jackets had a distinctive, rich butternut odor, a little like almonds toasted in butter, the promise of the delicious chambered meats inside. In my lifetime, the butternut contracted a fungus that developed into a fatal canker. Experts link the demise of the butternut to air pollution. It was the first tree on the endangered species candidate list. I went back to school when I was an adult, and my kids were pretty much grown, and studied history at Sir George Williams University in Montreal. At the time, I was living in St. Albans, Vermont, which is 60 miles south of Montreal, so it wasn't that bad a trip. Sir George Williams, now called Concordia, was a rather leftish school with a history department that honored the work of the French Annales school, Lefebvre, Baudel, La Vallée Dorée, and the strictures of history gradually began pushing me toward fiction. It wasn't so much the research and the footnotes that got to me as the fact that I could see that history was a pretty jello-like material, that it didn't stay put, that it changed with each generation, that it was always evolving. And from that bad thought, it was just a small step to fiction. However, the approach that I learned in the study of history very much influenced the way I write and the way I approach stories. Climate, weather, geography, place, how people live, how a region makes people behave. I wrote my first stories for Gray's Sporting Journal and Esquire, rather than Ladies' Home Journal or Mademoiselle. Editor Tom Jenks, or he was a sub-editor under Rust Hills, the famous old Esquire editor, liked my stories, and he went off to Scribner to become an editor there and said, why don't you let me put together something with a collection of short stories? You've got enough stories to make a volume. And that's exactly what happened. And that first collection was called Heart Songs, mostly concerns hill farm people in Vermont and hunting and fishing, two things that I liked very much. The contract included a future work that was just noted as novel at the time, and it later became Postcards. I did the research for this book. I followed my protagonist across the country. I wanted to have a Western state as part of the story, and I needed a place to stay, so I looked in the the Penn puts out a collection of fellowships and grants and awards and writers' colonies and so forth every year. And I looked in there and I found there was something in Wyoming, one thing, the U-Cross Foundation. And I knew nothing about it, but I applied and I was accepted and went out there and fell madly in love with the place. This is a habit of mine of falling in love with places, and it's, let me assure you, an expensive and dangerous habit. But Wyoming became my writing place for its long sight lines, for a thousand reasons. It was good to walk, and you walk your way through plots and problems and characterizations. It was just an excellent place to write. And that's what I've been doing for the last 14 or 15 years. In the meantime, I discovered Newfoundland, too. A friend and I went up there on a fishing trip. And I also fell in love with Newfoundland. My friend did not. Partly, I think, because bears smashed all of our crockery and came huffing round the tent one night. I slept through it, but my friend didn't. He was quite upset. In fact, we had to go back home immediately. Anyway, I did buy an old house in Newfoundland and had it fixed up, something that took a lot of money and a lot of time, and spent every part of every summer for the next 6 or 8 years up there. And from that came the book Shipping News. I then used to drive across the country every year from east to west or north to south, and in my rambles and travels, I occasionally drove across the Texas Panhandle. I became quite enamored of the Texas Panhandle. Yeah, it's the same old story. There were all of these, great tawny plains, and then Palo Duro, this great gash in the earth, then way down below were cattle walking about, but it used to be one of the last holdouts for the Comanches, and it was a very, very interesting place. I liked the whole feel of it. There were a lot of old deserted homesteads, and there were a lot of broken windmills. I have an attraction for out-of-the-way places and derelict places and houses that should never be attempted to fix up and that kind of thing. I don't know why. It's just how it is. Probably because we lived in a lot of that kind of house when I was a kid. No, happy times. So I spent some time in Texas when I was working. I was working on a book about windmills, or I thought I was. But before that, I got involved with accordions. I can't remember now how the accordion book came about, but I was interested in accordions, and I spent a lot of time with accordion builders, accordion repairmen, accordion enemies. And one of the best times I had was again in Texas, down around Austin with a very wonderful folklorist. And we went round together to all kinds of fantastic places, some really stompin', crazy nightclubs that were just unbelievable. One was built out over a creek, and you had to only dance on one side of the floor because the other side was quite dangerous. And then there was another place out on the highway that had a dance floor made of tiny little tiles. And before people came in to dance, they sprinkled something on that tile floor. I don't know what it was, but it was a slippery son of a gun. And in that particular place was some of the most fantastic dancing I have ever seen anywhere. It is quite hard to believe that all of the patrons weren't accomplished contortionists. That was rather great fun. And out of that came the book Accordion Crimes, which was also concerned with the immigrant life and the various groups of immigrants that came to North America, roughly 8 or 9 different groups. And you maybe can tell I like research. So I got to explore in many, many different directions. Mexican accordion players, some Polish accordion players, and some people from, a bandoneon player from Argentina. I can't remember all of the flavors of music, but it was grand fun listening to music. What a tough life. Just going around to dance clubs and hearing great music. I kept coming back to Wyoming in between all of this, and I did keep coming back to Texas, too. But finally, I started to write about Wyoming, and I bought a house. Yeah, another house. I bought a house on the east side of the Rockies, and unfortunately, that particular house was in a homeowners association. if there are people here who have experienced the homeowner association situation, you'll know that there are people who like it and there are people who don't. And I was one of the latter. There's always a Mr. Know-All, and this one was no exception. He knew how everything should go, everything, how everybody's house should have a steep driveway on the north side, how no one should be allowed to hang clothes on the line because it would bring down property values, how only he knew how to tamper with irrigation ditches and ruin the properties below. It was just one of those things. So I finally decided to look for another place. And a friend one day said, "Have you thought of Saratoga? Saratoga's on the west side of the Rockies, 50 miles to the west." So I said, "Yeah, well, it's beautiful over there, but I don't think there's much for sale." And she said, "Well, I'm on the board of the Nature Conservancy, and I do know of a place over there that's for sale." She said, "Do you know those big cliffs?" And I said, "Yeah, that's like a landmark." And she said, "Well, that's part of the property." So I said I would take a look at it, and I did take a look at it, and it was pretty wonderful. The cliffs were extraordinary, great pale slab of rock sticking up into the sky with the North Platte River running through the property. The property itself was a section, 640 acres, or a square mile, depending how you measure it. And to have the river running through this property was quite something. That's 2 miles of prime fishing water. So the guy who was handling the sale for the Nature Conservancy was taking me around and answering questions. And my first question to him, because it was a bit remote, it was about 8 miles out from the town of Saratoga on a spider web linkage of county roads. And I said, "Well, does the county maintain the roads in winter?" "Oh yeah, of course," he said. "No problem." So with that cheery thought, I thought long and hard and eventually bought the property. We built the house, big enough for all the books. And then came winter, the first winter. It began to snow, and it snowed, and it snowed, and the wind blew 80 miles an hour and packed the snow into something like white concrete. And I waited for the snowplow to come. I'm still waiting. It never came. The county does not maintain the road. So what I thought was going to be a final refuge turned out to be a summer place. Or 3 seasons at best, because if I'm lucky, I can stay until the end of December, and if I continue to be lucky, I can get back in March with the help from some friends. But generally, I stayed the first winter, but not since then. It's pretty difficult. So that leaves me homeless for part of the year. Which is not good. If you're a writer and you spend a lot of time with your books, and I have a good research library after years and 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 years of building it up, so I don't need to go to the big library at the University of Wyoming. I have my own, and in many areas it's better than theirs. So. I wrote the Wyoming stories, 30-odd of them, over the last 15 years or so in 3 volumes, and then I stopped. The reason I stopped, the book Bird Cloud, which is a memoir of place. It's about this place that I bought, where the winter never goes away. And the picture on the cover is springtime, with a great ice flow going down the river. But I have been gathering materials and thinking about writing a book about forests, writing a novel about forests and the people who worked in them for a long, long time. And I was finally able to start this year, so it's been great working on that. And part of what I was doing was examining trees and forests around the world. I was literally moving from PEI or Newfoundland, or actually Quebec is where I ended up, across the continent, down across the Pacific into New Zealand and finally Indonesia. New Zealand has been very important for me for this book. In fact, it was the genesis of the idea, because in New Zealand occurred one of the most horrific forest savagery tales on the globe, and that was the cutting of the great kauri trees, these massive, massive trees that were considered at one time the ideal tree. All the branches were at the top. The trunks were enormous. They had no knots because the branches were all at the top. And the wood was clear. It was a beautiful golden color. It was easy to work. Everything about it was ideal. It was tasteless. It had no odor. And it was used for many, many different things. But the trees were so enormous that getting them out was difficult. There are in New Zealand now swamps, prehistoric swamps full of fallen kauri trees that have been discovered, and they've been digging those up, and the wood is still good. So you can buy at a price a plank of 350,000 year old kauri wood if you've got the cash. So this year, I had a chance when I was in New Zealand to get close and personal with the kauri trees. After I was through with the book tour in Australia and New Zealand, I stayed on and in New Zealand to do some research. I was really afraid to drive on the left-hand side of the road because I had heard a disturbing statistic that every year about 100 tourists from right-hand driving countries die in road crashes in that beautiful country. I knew that I would have that problem because there are a lot of roundabouts. But a woman, Liz Allen, a very interesting woman who was introduced to me through the Michael King Writers Center, volunteered to drive me up into the Hokianga, which was up in the North Island on the west coast. She knew the area well and had relatives. And on the way, we could pass several museums, but most especially an enormous and extraordinary kauri museum in Matahoke. Very important research stop for me. And actually spent 2 days there until I could not walk another step. The director of this museum, Betty Nelly, had a little surprise. She said she had arranged a treat for Liz and for me, a twilight footprints trek into the Waipoua forest to see the massive surviving kauri trees. Those trees, Te Matua Nagere, the father of the forest, reckoned to be 4,000 years old, and Tane Mahuta, the lord of the forest, of an equal age. Our Maori guide, Kyle Tuhekearanga, called for us at our motel just before twilight. And as we advanced into the forest on a metal-cleated boardwalk, the light disappeared from the sky, and the shadows became very dense at ground level. The night sounds were just beginning, and we listened intently, hoping to hear the cry of the kiwi or even the moorpork. The moorpork is a little small brown owl, early white settlers in New Zealand heard the call as moorpork, moorpork. Our guide was voluble, full of information on plants and fauna. He was quite young, probably not more than 23 or 24. He was involved in a possum eradication program and told us that the animals, the possums, were brought to New Zealand from Australia in the early 19th century as the foundation of a fur trade. I should comment here that in Australia, the possum is very highly regarded and quite scarce and rare, and an exceedingly important thing if you are one of the Aboriginal tribes in Australia is a possum cloak. But possums are native to Australia, where there are lots of thorny trees and other pickery plants, and those plants repel them, and there are many predators there that dine on possums. New Zealand did not and does not have any armor-plated plants, and it does not have any possum predators. Everybody knows that the moa was a New Zealand bird that went extinct, and there were others as well. So in New Zealand, the possums had a field day. They multiplied prodigiously. They ate everything, especially young, tender cowrie sprouts and birds' eggs. The New Zealand government began control work in the 1940s, and possum fur is even used to make sweaters, socks, and hats. But 30 million of the creatures are still eating their way through the forests. Kiwi birds have another deadly enemy, alas, stoats. The stoat is a weasel relative, and it was brought into New Zealand in the late 19th century to control rabbits, which in their turn had been brought in. The stoat is a grand swimmer, and it's a tremendous killer of native bird species, especially the kiwi. Hideous statistic, up to 60% of the North Island kiwi hatchlings every year are killed by the possums. Ferrets, cats, and dogs kill another 35%. 95% of all kiwi hatchlings are killed in the first year. I think we're supposed to have some questions. Speak.
Yes. First of all, we hear that there's an opera possibly in production of Brokeback Mountain. Could that be true?
It could be true. Good. It is true. I think they're casting now. Good. Yes, and the premiere will be in Madrid in 2014. Gerard Mortier is the impresario and the head of the opera in Madrid, so see you there.
Really? Ms. Prue, the Laramie Project, the play based on the murder of Matthew Shepard, has become a formidable vehicle against gay bashing and hatred. I know you have said, unlike Charles Dickens, storytelling trumps social issues. But given that Brokeback Mountain changed many lives, brought resolution to long-lost love, would you bless perhaps a stage version that could be performed in, say, rural colleges and small local theater groups? And if not, why not?
Nobody has stepped forward to say, I want to put this into play form, except I think, I might be wrong about this, I believe someone in Finland asked for permission to do a version of it for stage, but not a full dress thing. I did see the Laramie Project when the first night they did it in Laramie, which was very uncomfortable for the performers because they had no idea how it was going to go. And it was terrifically moving, very, very powerful.
Hi, Miss Prue.
Hi.
Hi there. Since you don't give very many interviews and you're kind of a quote reclusive person, I thought I had read everything about your interests, but I am really quite thrilled that you are a fisherwoman. I too love to fish, and I'm a native Oregonian and fished every river in the state.
Good God.
I'm just curious. Is it the North Platte that runs through your property?
It is.
I was just curious, what are the fish species that you like to catch, and what is your mode of fishing? Are you a caster or a fly fisherwoman?
I fish with flies and
excellent
browns. I don't tie my own flies anymore, though. Long ago I used to, but I made such a mess of it that I leave it to the same people who can pick tiny wild strawberries are good at tying flies. But yeah, in the river we have browns and rainbows, and not a lot else. I think maybe some suckers.
Well, those are a couple of my favorites.
Good. Yeah, it's a good river, and we're lucky to have a mile of blue ribbon water with some quite splendid fishing. So next time you're in Wyoming, stop by, as long as it isn't winter.
Thank you.
Okay. I have a question that was asked on Facebook. Since we broadcast statewide, it's a chance for folks around the state to ask a question. And if there aren't other live questions, and one of them has to do with, is there a consistent, I mean, I think you've talked a little bit about novels and their stories and their genesis. Is there a consistent pattern to that genesis? I know you've talked a lot about research and place. Do you find that characters emerge sort of first, and then, or is it the place that speaks to you, or is it the history? Yeah. I mean, I'm just curious if there's a pattern, or maybe there isn't, but.
Yeah, there is. It's always the place. Once you understand something of a place, and I don't mean just Wyoming, but areas within a place that you're interested in, once you understand how people make their livings, what they do, where they meet, what the resources of the place are, whether it's changed a lot, so you have to know something of the history, all of those things. Once you understand those things, which can take a long time to find out, the rest of it just falls into place. A story just is there. It just drops out of knowing the rest of the stuff. That sounds a bit confused, but it works.
So what would you say is the sort of the most challenging part of that genesis for you, as particularly as a writer? Is there something that's you have trouble overcoming each time you put together a story or a book or a narrative?
It depends how far ranging the thing is. The thing that's most interesting maybe in constructing a story is dialogue, because it has to move the story along, it has to be accurate, and it has to have the character and flavor of the place. So getting that right can take quite a lot of time.
And when that book goes to your editor, have you had the same editor, the same person from Esquire?
No, he was only there. He was only there for a year, and then he left, and then I had another editor who was wonderful, and then she left. And I've had the same editor now for about 12 years, and she's excellent. There's not a lot of, there aren't many changes.
You're turning in polished, finished work pretty much to the.
Pretty much.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh. And do we know when the next novel is going to come out? Can you sneak us a glance at when it might be available? Or we're all kind of junkies, so.
I'm about a quarter of the way through. It's going to take a while. Sometime after the opera, probably. No, it's taking a while because it's a very complicated story. Right now, I have a person who went from France to Quebec in the 17th century, but now he suddenly ended up in Guangzhou in China. So, right. So I'm making my way through some of that. The whole Canton trade system, which is quite complicated.
So we have time for two more questions. So I think maybe down here on the...
What are some of the best places that you've read? You know, your favorite places in books, fictional, or a place that a book took you?
Place books. One that I very much like, a young Greek engineer moved to England some years ago, and he wrote a marvelous collection of short stories. His name was Panos Karnesis, and the title of the book is Little Infamies. And it's a riveting, enchanting collection of stories about a village of very stubborn, disagreeable, disbelieving Greek people who don't believe that a dam is going to be built and the flood come down upon them. So they refuse to move. And the stories are all based on this theme. And look it up sometime. It's quite a good read. But there are many. There are many good place ones. Peter Matheson is one of our great place writers. Yeah.
When you've chosen a place, to what extent are personal interviews part of your research?
Zero.
Zero.
The only time I did personal interviews was when I was working on the Accordion Crimes book, when I had to sit down with accordion makers and repairmen to see how it was done.
Maybe one more question from up top here.
I know a man, the only time he ever cried was when he read Brokeback Mountain out loud. And I wondered if you could talk about the inspiration for those characters.
That's an exceedingly difficult question. It's only been recently, because I'm not a person who looks back, and I'm not someone who tries to analyze their own writing or anything. I'm always involved in what's coming next and what's the thing I can be working on now. But I've only recently come to realize that during 14, 15, 16 years of living in a strong right-wing conservative state where almost everyone is white, where John Wayne is admired as the perfect kind of human being, where cowboys are believed to be decent and honest and noble and pure and very, very much involved with women only. I realize that a lot of the stories that I've written have been contrary to the Old West myths and mythology, contrary to the culture I live in, and maybe with a touch of the corrective about them. And I'm still thinking about that, so it's not really an answer. I'm not saying that's how it is, but I think that it's possible. In other words, the stories were not entirely written from a disinterested point of view. So, perhaps.
Thank you all.
That was Annie Proulx speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 2011. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.